get wings to fly. Oh, I'm alive.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show, a part of CQT's Off the Hour. Prison Radio has been on the air for more than 8 years. Prison Radio seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggle by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging our ideas about what prisons are and the people inside our jails. Prison Radio is dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. This is in the interest of forging stronger ties between incarcerated and non-incarcerated people, ensuring that prisoners have direct control over their representation and that our understandings of prisons be informed by those who live inside their walls. We invite anyone who is interested in sharing past archives or collaborating on programming to contact us. You can email news@ckut.ca or prison@ckut.ca. Or you can call us at 514-448-4041, extension 6788. You're listening to CKUT Montreal Community Campus Radio, located on 90.3 FM on the dial and www.ckut.ca online.
Good afternoon. You are listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Candace.
And my name is Stefan.
And we're your hosts for today's show. Today on the show, we have the third and final part of our interview with Lynn Jackson and Jean Finley from Project Salaam, who discuss the criminalization of Muslim men. They specifically speak about the cases of Yasin Arif and Mohammed Hussein, two men who were entrapped by the FBI in Albany, New York, and convicted as terrorists. We'll also be airing an interview with Amy Darwish, an organizer with Solidarity Across Borders. We'll be talking with Amy about the government's plan to build a new immigration detention center in Laval. But first, as we often do, we'll start the show with some news.
So according to CBC News, prisoners at the North Slave Correctional Complex in Yellowknife have mounted an unprecedented letter-writing campaign. They're asking for better opportunities to improve themselves while they're incarcerated and access to a large jail yard for recreation that's been closed for more than a year. Dozens of inmates wrote and signed letters to MLAs and the Justice Minister on Friday, describing their time in the facility as more akin to being warehoused than rehabilitated or prepared for reintegration with society outside prison walls. Prisoners say educational, career training, cultural, and recreational opportunities have diminished, especially since the closure of a large yard more than a year ago. Other complaints of reduced education programming and what inmates describe as overpriced long-distance phone calls and canteen offerings are consistent throughout most of the letters. Indigenous prisoners also say they have no access to traditional healing ceremonies like drumming or sweats, even though every day they can see the large outdoor yard where these types of ceremonies were previously practiced. Deputy Minister of Justice Martin Goldney says that the warden is talking to prisoners now as a result of this letter campaign, quote, to get a better understanding of what the mood is now and what might be driving some of that.
Also from CBC News, Canada's prison watchdog is raising the alarm about conditions at the Saskatchewan Penitentiary, describing the Prince Albert facility as forbidding and antiquated. In an annual report released Tuesday, correctional investigator Ivan Zinger raised concerns about several issues, including conditions at the Saskatchewan Penitentiary and the treatment of mentally ill female inmates in BC and the Yukon. He said inmate concerns over portion size and quality of food contributed to a riot at the Saskatchewan Penitentiary that left one inmate dead in December last year. Questions about hygiene conditions and access to basic needs, such as showers and exercises, were also noted in the report. Zinger's office has also asked Correctional Service Canada to explain its use of force by officers responding to the riot, during which 36 kilograms or 80 pounds of pepper spray was deployed. 80 pounds of pepper spray was deployed during the riot. Zinger visited the penitentiary after the riot and wrote a report with impressions of what he observed there, noting that many inmates were being kept two to a cell, even though there's barely adequate space for one. Zinger also noted the high number of Indigenous inmates in the facility and added that he believes the overrepresentation of Indigenous people in custody is one of Canada's most pressing human rights issues. He pointed out that at two of the largest and oldest penitentiaries in Canada, Saskatchewan Penitentiary and Stony Mountain Institutions in Manitoba, are in the prairies, and the majority of their inmates are Indigenous.
And according to the Globe and Mail, Canada's prison agency said it will review the way it treats inmates with opioid addictions in light of a series of accusations from BC-based prisoners. A letter sent to the Correctional Service Canada on Monday and shared with the Globe and Mail summarized the experiences of 33 prisoners held in the federal jailer's Pacific region, who said they couldn't access basic treatment for the highly addictive class of drugs that includes fentanyl and oxycodone. The Globe queried the CSC about the letter shortly after it was sent. The response was immediate, quote, "The CSC takes these allegations very seriously and will undertake a review of the application of opiate substitution therapy policy," end quote. Prisoners Legal Services, a Vancouver-based law clinic devoted to prison issues, brought the inmates' concerns forward in the 14-page letter. Some prisoners reported waiting months and even years to receive opiate substitution therapy. Legal advocate Nicole Keefe said that given the urgency of the situation, The prisoner's legal services hopes the review will happen immediately and will result in all prisoners who need treatment receiving it.
According to The Independent, a new report shows that the number of women and girls in prison around the world has jumped by more than half since the turn of the century. Women and girls now make up nearly 7% of the global prison population, says the study published by the Institute for Criminal Policy Research at Birkbeck University of London. The Prison Radio Show would like to note here that the World Female Imprisonment List, the report being referenced by The Independent, does not, to the best of our knowledge, include trans women being held in men's institutions in their statistics.
And finally, as part of the state elections held Tuesday in the U.S., prisoners, ex-prisoners, and their families in Pennsylvania are celebrating their work in the successful election campaign for a district attorney with a radical criminal justice reform agenda. According to an article on WagingNonviolence.org, which profiles the movement that elected Larry Kasner as DA of Philadelphia, prisoners in state institutions played a significant role in determining the platform of Kasner in regards to issues such as bail, life sentences, and more. A broad coalition, including groups such as Right to Redemption, an organization focusing on ending life without parole sentencing, or what they call death by incarceration, as well as the Latin American Cultural Exchange Organization, which represents Latino lifers, and the Gray Panthers, which represents elderly prisoners, came together to support Larry Kasner, who is renowned for suing police and defending groups like Black Lives Matter. Kasner has pledged to end bail for nonviolent offenses, as well as support for a state bill in ending life without parole, a policy which could affect as many as 5,000 currently incarcerated people in the state. Kasner also visited prisoners during his campaign.
And you are still listening to the Prison Radio Show here on CKUT. And up next, we're going to hear the last part of the interview that we did with Lynn Jackson and Jean Finley from Project Salaam. We met with two members of Project Salaam in Albany, New York. Project Salaam stands for Support and Legal Advocacy for Muslims. So they speak with us specifically about the cases of Yasin Arif and Mohammed Hussein, two men who were entrapped by the FBI and arrested in 2004 as terrorists. They were charged with 15 years in prison. And in this final part of the interview, Lynn Jackson and Jean Finley discuss some of the solutions for shutting down communication management units, also known as little gitmos. They also talk about the ending of racial profiling of Muslim men.
And every year we do a commemoration here in Albany of the anniversary of the arrests of Arif and Hossein. And every year, and it's been how many years now, Lynn?
I think we started in 2007. So this year was our 10th observation of the arrests of Yasin Arif and Mohammed Hossein. So we feel it's really important that the FBI knows that we're not going to forget that two of our fellow Albany resident citizens were targeted by the FBI. I mean, there are, of course, many other cases that we list in our report of inventing terrorists, the lawfare of preemptive prosecution. And some of these cases are pretty sad. I mean, it's bad enough that Yasin and Mohammed got 15 years of prison. They didn't get to watch their children grow up. But there are cases through this work that we've done. We met, we met Alicia McWilliams, who her nephew, David Williams, was one of the Newburgh 4 case. The Newburgh 4, the same informant was used that was used in our case, was used in the Newburgh 4 case. And those four men received 25 years in prison, which is just horrific as far as I'm concerned, because it's just outrageous, because they're completely entrapped by the government. There was no question there was entrapment. And then we met the Duca and the Schnur families, and their sons were entrapped in what they call the Fort Dix 5 case. So the Ducas had three sons, three adult sons. Between the three sons, they had six children. And the Mohammed Schnur, and they were entrapped in this case, and they were given life in prison for this. and they are completely innocent, and they just sit in prison. It's a horrible, horrible situation. And there are many more. There's like the Holy Land Foundation in Texas. There's the Abu Ali case in Washington.
Another one with life in prison.
Life in prison, yeah. People get life in prison essentially for being Muslim.
What do you think needs to happen to see these CMU prisons close down, to see fewer Muslim men arrested, see no men arrested, really? What do you think needs to happen for all of this to stop?
Well, we were pretty naive. We hoped that after Mr. Obama was elected, you know, everything would change. And the first things that Project Salaam did is we wrote letters to Mr. Obama and Mr. Holder and explained the cases and explained what was wrong. I think we wrote about 8 of these letters, and we had up to 1,000 people sign them, and we sent them to the government and got absolutely no response. But today, of course, the Americans, we elected the wrong person to be president, and the issues are so overwhelming at this point. You know, are we going to lose our democracy because what's at the White House? It's hard to even envision how are we going to go about, you know, we should not have the CMU. They should definitely be closed down. There should not be these horrible, inhumane prisons. We didn't even talk about the ADX Colorado, which I'm sure you perhaps have heard on it, Florence, Colorado, which is mostly a solitary confinement prison. You know, we need to get rid of solitary confinement. The ADX Colorado, to me, is how could we have a place like this? You know, we need to be kinder to people. We can't, we just, prisons should not treat people like this. And I think if we could go forward to really following the, you know, people's civil rights and the Constitution, you know, we'd be in a lot better shape. But the problem is when the FBI is if it's you versus the FBI, the FBI always wins. No regular person can fight the resources of the FBI. They just have, you know, an overwhelming, massive force. And I don't have any good solutions, unfortunately.
I think the predicate for making a change is to close Guantanamo. And though President Obama made a lot of noise about wanting to close Guantanamo, he did not. And he could have by executive order. We've seen certainly so many executive orders coming out of this White House, the Trump administration, overriding or preempting, we can use that word, Congress. The president has the authority to do that, and Obama could have done that, and he did not. So really, there is not a legacy of liberal or progressive thinking in this department. It's actually the opposite. And I think the Trump administration was emboldened by the fact that Guantanamo still exists. I don't think there have been any transfers to Guantanamo. There have been transfers out. Certainly, we've heard all about that. But there is still a significant population there. To have the United States of America operate a prison not on its own territory, and I'm not saying that Guantanamo Naval Base does not belong to the United States, it does, but it's 90 minutes off the coast of the United States. I consider it Cuba, as I'm sure the detainees do and their lawyers and just about the rest of the American population. If Guantanamo, with the torture that went on there, was done, that would not be the model for the solitary confinement, the incredible restriction of human rights that you get in the other prisons here in this country. And I think it would shake up the Bureau of Prisons and the courts and the Justice Department to realize, oops, we don't have Gitmo, now we've just got us. I'm not saying that that would do everything, but it would do something. And then I think the way to go is to trim away at this, for want of a better term, fascism, which is what the incredible prison advocates throughout the country have been doing on a statewide basis as well as on the federal level. New York State recently enacted some really good legislation prohibiting solitary confinement for more than, I believe, 15 days, prohibiting it completely, I believe, for juveniles in the state prisons. That's not the federal level, but it's becoming a model for other states. And you trim away, and you trim away, and you trim away at this monolithic power structure of the Bureau of Prisons, based on the fact that this is not what the United States is about. There's an awful lot of people saying this is not what the United States is about on other issues, and we'll bring in prison reform as well.
What can people do who are listening? What can they do to support the work of Project Salaam?
Well, I would hope that people would learn more about these cases and read our report of Inventing Terrorists, the Lawfare Preemptive Prosecution. Also, people can listen to our podcast. And in the podcast, we explain a great deal about Yassin Arif's case. And you can find that at terrortalk.org. And also, I would hope that people would write to some of the men who have been in prison, and maybe even get to know the families to help them out, because this is to be sentenced to life in prison for something that you didn't do is pretty hard. It's pretty harsh.
And I think also supporting a local Muslim community wherever people are. The Muslim community has been under fire, not only here, certainly with preemptive prosecution, but now certainly with the Muslim bans trying to be enacted in the United States. The Muslim community has come out strong. They were targeted, they were attacked, but I believe the communities across the country have come out in support of the American way, and I think that's an important component of it, to get to know the Muslim community, to get to know individuals. They're your neighbors, they're your colleagues, they're your friends, they're your co-workers, and just like any other targeted minority, it helps to know on a one-to-one basis, because then you have a very strong bond, which is friendship. So you do it on the higher level, you do it on the mid-level, you do it on the state level, and you do it on the personal level. And I think that will go a long way. I just wanted to also say that these publications that I referred to earlier, Son of Mountains, Rounded Up, Inventing Terrorists, are all available on the Project Salaam website, which is projectsalaam1a.org.
And that was the last bit of the interview with Project Salaam. Lynn Jackson and Jean Finley from Albany, New York, also do a podcast. It is called Terror Talk, and so you can listen to more of what they have to say about inventing terrorism in America.
And the time is presently 5:23 in Montreal. You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and streaming live at www.ckut.ca.
Culture Shock 2017, November 7th to 12th at locations around Montreal. Join Kupert McGill for a series of workshops, panels, film screenings, and fundraisers on anti-racism, migrant justice, and Indigenous solidarity. Events to include Anti-Racism 101, World Without Walls panel on resistance to border violence, No Permission Needed, a film screening on mutual aid in an age of climate catastrophe, Our Bodies, Our Stories performance night, and more. All events are wheelchair accessible, free, and open to all. More information is available at cultureshockseries.com. Culture Shock 2017, a CKUT co-presentation.
Una pierna que... soplando aguardiente.
El día había comenzado entusiasmado y alegre.
Dice, pasaporte.
¿A dónde va por ahí, Juan Hilario, con esta noche tan fea? ¿Usted no se anima? Mire cómo está el camino, anegadito. No, hombre, compa, el camino es lo de menos.
Lo importante es llegar.
Tengo tu antídoto. Somos idénticos.
Tranquilo sin avisar.
Tengo tranquilito.
Para lo que ya no están, para lo que están y lo que viene.
Tengo tu antídoto. Somos idénticos.
Tranquilo sin avisar.
Tengo tranquilito.
Para lo que ya no están, para lo que están y lo que viene.
Un nómada sin rumbo. La energía negativa yo la derrumbo con mis pezuñas de cordero. Me propuse a recorrer el continente entero, sin brújula, sin tiempo, sin agenda, inspirado por las leyendas, por historias empaquetadas en lata, por los cuentos que la luna relata. Aprendí a caminar sin mapa, a irme de caminata, sin comodidades, sin lujo, protegido por los santos y los brujos. Aprendí a escribir cabronerías en mi libreta y con un mismo idioma sacudir todo el planeta. Aprendí que mi pueblo todavía reza porque las fucking autoridades y la puta realeza todavía se mueven por debajo de la mesa. Aprendí a tragarme la depresión con cerveza. Mi patrono yo lo escupo desde las montañas y con mi propia saliva enveneno su champaña. Enveneno su champaña.
Tengo tu antídoto. Somos idénticos.
Tranquilo sin avisar.
Tengo tranquilito.
Para lo que ya no están, para lo que están y lo que viene.
Tengo tu antídoto. Somos idénticos.
Tranquilo sin avisar.
Tengo tranquilito.
Para lo que ya no están, para lo que están y lo que viene.
En tu sonrisa yo veo una guerrilla, una aventura, un movimiento. Tu lenguaje, tu acento, yo quiero descubrir lo que ya estaba descubierto. Ser un emigrante, ese es mi deporte. Hoy me voy pa'l norte, sin pasaporte, sin transporte. A pie con las patas, pero no importa, este hombre se hidrata. Con lo que retratan mis pupilas. Cargo con un par de paisajes en mi mochila. Cargo con vitamina de clorofila. Cargo con un rosario que me vigila. Sueño con cruzar el meridiano, resbalando por las cuerdas del 4 de Aureliano y llegarle tempranito, temprano a la orilla. Por el desierto con los pies a la parrilla. Vamos por debajo de la tierra como las ardillas. Yo voy a cruzar la muralla. Yo soy un intruso con identidad de recluso. Y por eso me convierto en buzo y buceo por debajo de la tierra. Pa' que no me vean los guardias y los perros no me huelan. Abuela, no se preocupe, que en mi cuello cuelga la Virgen de la Guadalupe.
Y con esfuerzo, sea como un llamado de voluntad y esperanza para todos, 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 todos.
And that was the song Pal Norte by Calle 13. Up next, we'll be hearing from Amy Darwish. She's an organizer with Solidarity Across Borders. And in this interview, Amy talks about the government's plan to build a new immigration detention center in Laval, the political context in which this decision was made, and what is being planned to resist the construction of the center.
So first off, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Amy Darweesh, and I'm a member of Solidarity Across Borders, which is a Montreal-based migrant justice network that works in solidarities with individuals and families who are confronting an unjust immigration system. We demand an end to detentions, to deportations, to double punishment, and we also call for status for all.
What can you tell us about the proposed plan to build a new immigration detention center on the island of Montreal?
So this summer, the federal government announced that they would be building a new immigration detention center in 2020. When it's completed, the center will have 120 beds, which would either maintain or slightly increase the capacity of the current detention center's capacity. At this stage, we know that the government has released a call for proposals over the summer. We know that the detention center will be located in Laval and within a 30-kilometer radius of the airport, presumably to allow the CBSA to deport and detain people more readily, but we haven't yet confirmed the exact location.
Okay. So in Laval, but probably closer to the airport than the one that currently exists.
It's unclear whether they will be building it on or nearby the existing detention center site or if it'll be in another place entirely.
Okay. What do you think are the political implications of this plan to build a new immigration detention center?
Mm-hmm. So the plan to build a new immigration detention center is taking place in the context of an announcement made by Public Safety Minister Ralph Goodale in August 2016 when he allotted $138 million to expand immigration detention infrastructure across the country. Just 2 days ago, actually, Goodale also called on the CBSA to expand alternatives to detention, such as it can be anything from like cash bonds, community supervision, and in-person reporting. He also called on the CBSA to avoid detaining children where humanely possible, but didn't give any kind of clear directives as to what that could look like, and as such, there's absolutely no guarantees that this couldn't result in children, in more migrant children ending up in the youth protection system. It's also important maybe to note that the call for proposals for the Laval Immigration Detention Center also called for the new center to be not as institutional in appearance, and that for elements of security and control, to not give it the appearance of a correctional center. In a lot of ways, it sort of seems like they're trying to give the impression that detention can be done in a more humane way while actually maintaining the status quo and saying they want to detain fewer people while actually drastically expanding immigration detention centers. We believe that detention can't be done in a kinder, more humane way, and we don't think detention centers need an upgrade. We think they should be shut down altogether.
One of the other things I was thinking of in terms of this question is the news that there's going to be some kind of new immigration detention center somewhere in southern Ontario, around the Toronto area, and that happening in the context of like years of folks fighting for an end to immigration detention and kind of the tensions around there. Do you have any thoughts on the situation over there?
It's important maybe to point out that the announcement to allot $138 million to renovate and expand detention centers was actually made following one of the more recent hunger strikes led by detainees at the Central East Correctional Center. At the time, Goodale actually refused to meet with them and instead made this announcement.
Do you want to talk about what this means in the context of the situation in the U.S.? I know a lot of people have been hearing a lot of news about people walking across the border of Roxham Road and Trump ordering ICE to deport more people in general. Like, what do you think? How do you think that relates to things going on here?
Mm-hmm. So between mid-March and September, an estimated 10,000 migrants have crossed the border, often through crossings like Roxham Road or nearby Hemingford, Quebec. In a lot of instances, people were leaving the United States sort of following an escalation in rhetorics and attacks from the Trump administration, which have included everything from attempted travel bans to immigration raids, to attacks on different communities, including like Muslims and Arabs and Latinx folks, as well as more recently they've announced that they were going to be revoking temporary status, which could leave up to like 58,000 Haitian migrants at risk of deportation in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Because of the Safe Third Country Agreement, migrants can't make refugee claims at regular posts, which actually forces them to make irregular crossings, sometimes in very like dangerous conditions. In recent weeks, we've also been getting reports that the RCMP has been acting much more aggressively and intimidatingly towards migrants who've tried to cross. We've heard everything from them telling people this is a terrible way to start your new life in a new country. In other instances, they've told people to get back in the taxi, telling them that if they dared to cross, they would be deported back to their home countries almost, you know, immediately, which is actually patently false. Also, in some instances, given people deliberate misinformation and told them to cross at regular border crossings, which would basically lead to them, you know, never being able to file a refugee claim again and losing their only shot at having permanent status in Canada. For those who do manage to get across, in the absence of a regularization program for all migrants and in the context of sort of case-by-case decisions on people's files, we are anticipating that a large number of people will be refused status over the next, you know, few years. And we imagine that the expansion of immigration detention center capacity is going to be part of a broader program to detain and deport people more readily. In this sense, the RCMP, like RCMP intimidation, as well as the recent expansion of detention center infrastructure, are sort of two sides of border enforcement's racist and exclusionary coin.
Can you talk about the current situation with immigration detention centers in Canada and in Montreal, and maybe give us like a bit of a what led us up to the point that we're at now?
Yeah, absolutely. So basically, there are three dedicated immigration detention centers in Canada. There's one in Vancouver, one in Toronto, and one in Laval. Outside of Quebec, a large number of detainees are also held in provincial prisons, often in maximum security conditions, where they're unable to leave their cells for up to 18 hours a day. At the Laval Immigration Detention Centre, there are up to about 109 folks who can be detained on any given day. Once people are there, they face conditions such as very rigid rules, very regimented schedules. They're under constant surveillance. Folks who've been through the detention centres have often spoken of having a lot of difficulty accessing medical services or legal support, as well as having a lot of trouble reaching family members and loved ones. On the outside, it's also important to highlight that there have been at least 16 deaths that we've known of in detention since the year 2000. In fact, just last week, a 50-year-old woman died at the Vanier Center for Women in Ontario. It seems that the CBSA actually has a great deal of difficulty keeping people alive, and for this reason, maybe they shouldn't be detaining people at all.
So let's go back to this proposal about a new immigration detention center in Montreal. What's been going on to resist this as a plan, and can you sum up for people why it makes sense to oppose it?
In February 2017, a group of people came together to try to respond proactively to the announcement to be expanding detention infrastructure. In particular, we were very much inspired by the hunger strikes that had been taking place at the Central East Correctional Center, and by the fact that the End Immigration Detention campaign had been very much informed by demands of folks on the inside, and we wanted to make sure that our campaign sort of reflected the priorities of folks who had been through the detention center themselves. With this in mind, we held an assembly in early March 2017 to get feedback and input from folks who've been through detention themselves. Since then, we have been meeting to come up and build a campaign. We've been hoping to do have included coming up with a sign-on letter for different community groups around the new detention center, organizing media and public actions once the site of the detention center becomes more clear. One thing that's especially come out of our conversations with folks who've been through the detention system is the importance of also focusing on the things that give that lead people to be detained in the first place. For instance, we've heard a number of reports of folks being detained after they were asked for ID as passengers in a car, or being stopped while crossing on a red light when a number of other people were not stopped. In addition, there's also been recent reports that the Montreal police made more than 2,800 calls to border services in 2016 alone, and in 83% of those cases, the calls were actually being made to verify people's status. With this in mind, we think it'll be very important for us to also highlight questions of racial profiling and police collaboration with the CBSA.
Do you have a sense of the timeline? Like, do you have any idea when the government's going to reveal both who has this contract to build the new center and where it's going to be?
At this point, we're aware that a number of companies have expressed interest in the contract, but we're not entirely clear on what the timeline will look like of when a final decision will be made about who will be building it and where it will be built. We definitely look forward to keeping everyone up to date as to how that unfolds.
And if people are curious to learn more, I know End Immigration Detention has a website, which I can add at the end of this piece, but is there a way for folks to learn more about the campaign that you're a part of? Is any of it public or online yet?
Not yet, but we encourage people to keep up to date at solidaritycrossborders.org.
Okay. Is there anything else that I forgot? Is there anything you want to add?
I think that just about covers it. Thanks so much for having me today.
Thanks for coming.
And that was Amy Darwish, an organizer with Solidarity Across Borders, talking about the federal government's plan to build a new immigrant detention center in Laval. In the interview, the End Immigration Detention Campaign in Ontario was mentioned. To find out more about them, you can visit endimmigrationdetention.com, and the website for Solidarity Across Borders is solidaritycrossborders.org. We're going to take a quick music break, listen to Tikenja Fakoli with his song Ouvrez les frontières, which you'll likely hear at a demo this coming Sunday. There's a big anti-racist demo in Montreal, and you'd have to work pretty hard to not know about it, but if you can make it out to that, I think it's at 2 p.m. or noon or something on Sunday. So here's Tikenja Fakoli.
Comme l'hiver, et nous on vous reçoit toujours les bras ouverts. Vous êtes ici chez vous, après tout peu importe. On veut partir alors, ouvrez-nous la porte.
Ouvrez les frontières, ouvrez les frontières. Ouvrez les frontières, ouvrez les frontières.
Du Cap à Gibraltar, nous sommes des milliers à vouloir comme vous venir sans rendez-vous. Nous voulons voyager et aussi travailler, mais nous on vous a pas refusé le visa.
Ouvrez les frontières, ouvrez les frontières. Ouvrez les frontières, ouvrez les frontières.
Nous aussi on veut connaître la chance d'étudier, la chance de voir nos rêves se réaliser. Avoir un beau métier, pouvoir voyager, connaître ce que vous appelez liberté.
Ni même une goutte de pluie, tout au fond du puits. En levant très vite sur le chemin de l'école,
décide de prendre son envol.
To the Prison Radio Show here on CKUT 90.3 FM, 5:46 p.m. With the remaining time we have here on the show before 6 o'clock, we are going to be sharing with you the latest prisonradio.org commentaries. We are going to hear now from Mumia Abu-Jamal with him honoring the memory of Dennis Banks here on CKUT.
Dennis Banks, warrior for Indian rights, presente. In the late 1960s and early 1970s, two names emerged from the Native American and indigenous community that stood for resistance to white repression and assaults on Native life, Russell Means and Dennis Banks. They were men who lived, at times, in urban America and experienced its impoverishment as well as its penchant for broken dreams. In a time of mass resistance and social upheaval shown by the anti-war and black liberation movements, Banks was among thousands of young activists of Native indigenous communities who rose up to speak and act on behalf of the oppressed. In 1968, after leaving prison, Banks joined forces with Clyde Belcourt to found the American Indian Movement, AIM, which sought to organize scattered Native clan members into a militant, cohesive unit. At its height, it had some 25,000 members. AIM activists held protests at historic sites to draw attention to U.S. massacres of Native peoples, as well as present-day injustices. In 1970, Banks and Means declared a day of mourning to mark Thanksgiving Day, when AIM activists seized the replica ship dubbed the Mayflower 2 in Plymouth, Massachusetts, on TV when real Indians confronted whites in Indian garb. In 1972, a national caravan of hundreds seized the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington for a week to protest a long train of broken trees. In 1973, AIM activists led by Banks seized the town of Wounded Knee, South Dakota, the site of the infamous massacre of Indians in 1890. The siege, lasting over 70 days, would become a 20th century hotspot of conflict, armed conflict, between AIM and agents of the U.S. government. In his later years, Banks became an actor, and his striking, chiseled features filled many a screen. He later became an educator in several colleges for Indian youth. On Sunday, October 29th, Dennis Banks, Ojibwe, living in his northern Minnesota Leech Lake Reservation, closed his eyes on the same land where his eyes first opened 80 winters ago. From Imprisoned Nation, This is Mumia Abu Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
My name is Charles Kareem Diggs. I'm calling from Graterford Prison in Pennsylvania. The title of my little speech is, Are We Willing to Imagine? Try to imagine a prison system that uses its resources to cure, heal, and build human values and character. Every state and federal prison system has one common denominator, and that is security. They also have programs, school, trade, and organizational activities. Nothing trumps security. Most prisons conduct body counts 3 and 4 times each day. They also count numerous times while you are asleep. There is not much rehabilitation under that design. Meals take up the rest of your time. And we imagine a prison system reflecting modern technology, neuroscience, and returning human beings back to society with more values and a sense of belonging. American prison system is a failure. First, the priority is everything is about security. Prisons are counted and counted and counted. The visitors are counted. This fear is ingrained in the entire system. Secondly, the type of stress associated with counting bodies expresses a level of fear and anxiety. There is no imagination for change. A healthy design for prisons is lost in the very construction of the prisons. With two prisoners in a small cell and limiting number of toilet flushes every 15 minutes is a waste of talent. To save water and to maximize space seems to be the reasons to spend between $200 and $400 million to build one prison. The governors and prison commissioners need courage to imagine a prison system built to develop the moral and social skills needed to function in society. Criminologists and prison experts need to take on a new imagination that represents a wholesome strategy that will return missing women and men back to society, a balanced person. After the prisons are built, it takes another $50 to $70 million to operate with staff. The banks provide the bonds and the taxpayers pay it off. Whatever city or county that a person is sentenced from, that is the county that pays the state to house you. It has become a business model for containing citizens for long periods of time. In this 21st century, with the advancement in science and the human brain, I believe we could design a prison system that helps the prisoner develop a positive, law-abiding place in society. With 3 million people in prison, suffocating in prison, we may want to take another look and try imagining a system that will create the type of person who will return to society, a secure mental person. This imagination requires that we remove the obsession with security as a tool for managing human beings. Human beings living inside of buildings don't need more layers of domination over them. And finally, the beginning of healing, it comes from our imagination that these people in prison have somehow become flawed in their moral values. Intelligent prison managers and governors have the resources to change the dehumanizing systems. We don't need more money. We need human beings to imagine a different world inside of prisons. Thank you.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Got a letter from the government the other day. Opened it and read it. It said they were suckers. They wanted me for the army or whatever. Picture me giving a damn. I said never. Here is a land that never gave a damn about a brother like myself. Cause I never did. I wasn't with her, but just that very minute it occurred to me that suckers had authority. Cold sweating as I dwell in my cell. How long has it been? They got me sitting in a state pen. I gotta get out, but the thought was dormant.
The song Black Steel by Tricky, based on the song Black Steel in the Hour of Chaos by Public Enemy. You have been listening to the Prison Radio Show here on CQT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at CQT.ca. You can check out past episodes of the Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Prison Radio Show. We air twice a month on CQT. We're on the air the second Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. and the fourth Friday at 11 a.m., which means that our next show will air on Friday, November 24th at 11 a.m. If you have any questions on anything that you've heard on today's show or you wish to be involved in the show, you can contact us at prison@cqt.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. Folks can also leave a message on our listener comment line at 514-448-4041, extension 2547. If you are in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. You can write to us at The Prison Radio Show or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. So thank you for tuning in to the Prison Radio Show on CQT. My name is Candace.
And I'm Stefan.
And we've been your hosts for today. Stay tuned.